Welcome to The Daily, Karen.
Good morning, Miles.
Now, I just want to understand a little bit about Rape and Domestic Services Australia and the role it's played in sexual assault counselling over the past few years in Australia. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. We've been around since 1971. We started out as New South Wales Rape Crisis Centre. So we've been providing 24/7 telephone and online crisis counselling to anyone whose life has been impacted by sexual assault. In 2010, we also became the clinical service provider for 1-800-RESPECT, which means that anyone anywhere in Australia whose life was impacted by sexual assault or domestic violence, they could ring us and gain immediate access to a highly qualified and experienced trauma counsellor who would assist them in whatever way was most beneficial to them to get to where they needed to be in terms of their progress towards recovery.
And do you know roughly how many people annually your counsellors would speak to?
Certainly. We provided around about 60,000 occasions of service a year. And in the 6 years that we were operating as a clinical provider, we spoke to 77,000 individuals.
Now, 77,000 people, that seems like a quite a large number. What impact will the withdrawal from the 1-800-RESPECT Trauma Counselling Service have on the community?
1-800-RESPECT will continue to function, but it will be under a different model organised by Medibank, which is, as you know, a private health insurance company. Their focus will be on ensuring that every call's answered. And I don't have a problem with that focus. But what our position is when you answer that call, you absolutely need to have a qualified and experienced trauma counsellor who can provide the best possible service. So it was, I think, a decision for the government between answering each call and ensuring quality service provision. We certainly had up to 15% of people who called us in any 1 year couldn't get immediately through, and that was absolutely not good enough. The Full Stop Foundation, which is a fundraising organisation, its number one call was help us answer every call, trying to raise funds to employ additional counsellors so that we could answer every single call. But once we answered that, we needed to make sure that we provided the best possible response to that caller. And as you mentioned in your introduction, one of the things that will change under this new model is that a thing called the Recontact Service will no longer be available. That was a service that we set up for some of the most vulnerable people in our society, people who'd experienced sexual assault in childhood, then further domestic violence and sexual assault in adolescence and adulthood. As you can imagine, the impacts on the individual of that kind of violence over a lifetime, it can be quite devastating for them. And so what we did with the Recontact Service was have a very specifically individually tailored counselling program for each and every one of those clients. They would ring us, leave a message, we'd look up their file notes and ring them back so that we can provide a consistent and seamless service. There were 600 women on that accessing that service, 200 currently active. Now, if they want a service, they're just going to have to go through the Medibank triage process and take their luck, which we actually don't think is the quality service provision that they have a right to expect. And, you know, we have an obligation to provide, actually.
You're listening to the Monday Daily. My guest is the Executive Officer of the Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia. Now, if this interview, if you've been listening so far, has raised any concerns for yourself or anyone you know, please do feel free to call Lifeline on 13 11 14. Now, Karen, I want to ask about, I suppose, something you touched on there, which is this idea of needing to answer more calls. But do you think decision to focus on that will result in perhaps a decline in the quality of service that can be provided? And if that is the case, what will be the effect of that?
There's, for non-government organisations like ourselves, it's absolutely always a challenge. Over the last couple of years, more and more women have been, particularly women, men too, but mostly women, have been coming forward to talk about the sexual assault and domestic violence they've experienced. And that's a great outcome for 40 years of work of the women's movement and more recently a whole lot of work by governments and individuals and media to encourage those who've experienced such violence to understand that it's not their fault, they're not to blame, and they have a right to safety and they have a right to the most marvellous of life, whatever that might be, and that we should be there to assist them to achieve that. So what that has meant for sexual assault and domestic violence services across the country is we have been overwhelmed. There's not a service in the country that doesn't have a waiting list or isn't doing everything they can to meet demand. And I suppose a simple way to look at it might be that if you have 10 people at your door wanting services, you bring six in, you find out exactly what their individual needs are, you tailor a program to meet their needs, you assist them to get to where they want to be. You've assisted them to take their first step towards recovery. But there's four people there who you haven't done anything for.
Now,
the other way of doing it is bringing in the whole 10, providing a generic service and seeing them on their way, and quite possibly eight will be back the next day because you haven't actually provided what they need. So, you know, that's the dilemma that goes on forever.
And so I suppose that you speak about, and I think the dilemma is a very accurate way of characterising it. Do you think, how do you try and tailor a service that meets the most amount of people whilst also not compromising on the quality? Is there a way to do that? Is there a kind of avenue for policies to be pursued that can make that difference?
Yes, increase the funding so we can provide more counsellors so we can do the job. It's, you know, I mean, at the what the Australian
statistics do you think that is?
Tells us, well, in our case, no. I mean, the Australian Bureau of Statistics tells us that less than 20% of people who experience sexual assault or domestic violence access police or other services. So we, and that was 5 years ago. My view is we might have bumped that up to 20%. And at the moment, what we are seeing as a result of that is our police, our services and our courts are being overwhelmed. We're not responding to that need. We're saying to women, you have a right to live your life safe and free of violence, but we're not providing the right assistance to assist them to do that. We also need to do the prevention so that people don't experience in the first place. It's a two-pronged approach. But if we're going to stand there and say, you have a right to live your life free and safe from violence, then we need to make sure that when a person makes that decision to seek assistance, that assistance is available. And we haven't done that. I was speaking to a magistrate the other day and I was saying to him in relation to a protection order, but hang on, did you know about this? Did you think about that? Did you look at this, darling? And he said, hang on, I have 3 minutes per decision here, 3 minutes. I thought, there's no way that you can actually sum up two people's lives and provide a reasonable response in 3 minutes. I was speaking to a police officer, a crime manager, who was saying in relation to a sexual assault matter, it was a fairly straightforward matter. He said, what I really need is two detectives for 8 hours and I could wrap this up. I've got one detective who I can give 1 hour to. Services like ours, yes. You know, we might provide 60,000 occasions of service in a year, but there's another 10,000 people who are trying to get through who can't. We often have people who we might be working with for a couple of months, supporting them until they can get access to their local face-to-face service providers because there's a waiting list. We know that across the country, refuges are inundated. So we've got problems, doesn't matter where we look at sexual assault and domestic violence, let alone when we start to talk about prevention.
Now, I want to just touch on domestic violence and sexual assault as a together, but particularly focusing on the fact that domestic violence is one of the lead killers of women in Australia. And I want to ask about that. And just quickly, as we lead up to the news at 11 o'clock, is that with this decision around perhaps not only this funding decision, but do you think this speaks broadly to a policy direction we're going with? Do you think we're moving forwards or backwards in terms of trying to reduce the amount of sexual assault cases and domestic violence cases that occur, but also actually improving the services that are rolled out to them?
I think what the problem is that a lot of people in positions of power, and including organisations like Medibank, actually don't understand the complexities and difficulties of the issue and think that you can just do a fairly short, quick intervention and everything will be fixed. And in fact, and that's the case for some, but overwhelmingly you need to do a lot more. The other key reason that we're actually not part of the 1800 Respect Service or will be withdrawing as of the end of October is that Medibank want us to hand over those 77,000 client file notes, and we've refused to do that. We said, no, those women have trusted us with their stories and we're not giving them to a private health insurance company. We thought that was fairly appalling. And so that's actually the reason that we have withdrawn from the service, because we just couldn't conscience the idea of handing over.
Karen Willis, we're going to have to wrap it up there. Thank you very much for joining
today. Thank you very much, Miles.